Today on the 21st Show, the life and legacy of civil rights leader Jesse Jackson. He sought to carry on the work of Martin Luther King and twice ran for president in the Democratic primary.
We must leave racial battleground and come to economic common ground and moral higher ground. America, our time has come.
Jackson was based in Chicago for most of his career, but despite his national prominence, he would also become involved in causes here in Illinois, including downstate, on behalf of women at an auto plant in Bloomington, high school students facing expulsion in Decatur, and everyone in Illinois left holding the bag when state leaders shirked their responsibility to pass a budget.
And if it means sitting in the room all day and all night, let's hammer it out. I'm willing to help be a part of such a meeting.
I'm Brian Mackey, the life of Jesse Jackson, today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we gather today to remember the life and legacy of Jesse Jackson, one of the last living connections to the civil rights era. Jackson came to prominence as one of the youngest aides of Martin Luther King and was present on the balcony at the Lorraine Motel when King was assassinated. He talked about it to the press shortly after.
Dr. King has been a buffer the last few years between the black community and the white community. The white people do not know it, but the white people's best friend is dead.
At the time, Jackson was leading Operation Breadbasket in Chicago, the organization that would become Rainbow Push, a base from which he became a national figure and launched two runs for president. In his activism and those campaigns, Jackson sought to bridge racial, gender, and other divides in American life.
When we say feed the hungry, they're more white hungry than black. We say give houses to the homeless, they're more whites in cars without houses than blacks. When we say give jobs to the jobless, there are more unemployed whites than blacks. We respect women, there are more white women on food stamps than black and brown women. We're talking about life from a black perspective.
Those campaigns in 1984 and 88 were unsuccessful in getting Jackson the Democratic presidential nomination, but they arguably set the tone for future Democratic Party policy aims and for another black man based on the south side of Chicago to succeed where Jackson had failed 20 years earlier. Beyond his national prominence, Jackson was also a figure of international renown and over the years helped secure the release of hundreds of Americans from places like Serbia, Iraq, and Syria, where a young black naval aviator named Robert Goodman had been shot down while patrolling the skies over Lebanon. This clip is from CBS News, 1984.
It was an extraordinary sight, the conservative Republican president embracing the black Democratic presidential candidate at a joyful White House homecoming ceremony, as Mr. Reagan called the event. Reversing his earlier criticism of the Jackson mission, the president had nothing but praise today.
Reverend Jackson's mission was a personal mission of mercy, and he has earned our gratitude and our admiration.
Despite his work across the country and overseas, Jackson continued to keep an eye on Chicago and Illinois and would use his ability to draw media attention to highlight injustice here in the 21st state. Whether that was sexual harassment at the Mitsubishi plant in Normal in the mid-1990s, a group of schoolchildren who were expelled for a fistfight in Decatur in 1999, and the budget impasse that affected every corner of Illinois in the mid-2010s. The Reverend Jesse Jackson died last week at the age of 84. He's going to have his ceremonies and remembrances in wake this week. And all of this is the subject of our program today. I'm pleased to be joined by an all-Illinois panel. Hermine Hartman is the founder and publisher of Indigo, the media organization based in Chicago. Ms. Hartman, thank you for joining us again today.
Thank you. Indigo. Mm-hmm.
And Minnie Pearson is president of the NAACP in Champaign County. Ms. Pearson, welcome back to the 21st Show to you as well.
Thank you so much.
Marcia Barrett is professor of history at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. Professor Barrett, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And Courtney Carson is based in Decatur. He's minister for Antioch Missionary Baptist Church. He's also vice president of external affairs at Richland Community College. And also noteworthy for our conversation today, he met Jackson first in 1999. He was one of those black students expelled from the school district there after that fight in the stands of the football game. Jackson visited Decatur to support them. Carson remained in touch with him for a time after that. He even served on the school board later. Mr. Carson, welcome to the 21st Show.
Blessings to you. Thank you for having me.
Listeners, we also want to hear from you throughout the hour today. We have text messages we've collected from our listeners, but you can call in live as well at 800-222-9455. Your memories of Jesse Jackson, what stands out to you about his life and work, and what you think his legacy will be. 800-222-9455. Courtney Carson, I want to begin with you. You were a teenager when you first met Jesse Jackson, and in pretty difficult circumstances, I would imagine. Tell me about that first meeting.
It was different because Reverend Jackson was such a huge figure. He walked into a room and I saw a halo over his head. And I asked my mom, "My gosh, is this man glowing?" And at first I did not want to go to the church on that night because I was trying to convince everyone that I wasn't a part of that fight. I did not want to get in trouble. But however, my mother made me go to that church that night where I met Reverend Jackson. And that night changed my life significantly, wholeheartedly and unequivocally. And I use those words in a way that for me makes so much sense because I don't take it lightly. He was my mentor, my lifesaver, my father figure. He was more than the greatest civil rights leader that I've ever known. He was more than the individual that ran for president. I love him and I miss him so much.
Hermine Hartman, I want to come to you now, publisher of Indigo. How did you get to know Jesse Jackson?
I was a student in school at Roosevelt University, and after Dr. King died, Breadbasket here exploded with the meetings that were held then at the Parkway Ballroom. And I began to go to the meetings. On Saturday mornings, there was a little girl with her grandmother. And you know how you go to church or you go to something that you go to regularly, you kind of have a seat or people that you sit with. And they became the people that I sat with. And one day the older lady, I played with the little girl, she sat on my lap, she was such a sweetie. And the lady said, "You're a college student, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." And she said, "What are you studying?" And I said, "Sociology." And she says, "My grandson studied sociology and I think you should meet him. He may be able to help you with your lessons." And I said, "Okay, I'll be happy to meet him." Well, her name was Tibby. She was Jesse's grandmother. And that little girl was Santita Jackson. And her grandson was Jesse Jackson. So we met and we liked each other and I liked the family. And they invited me home for lunch. And I went for lunch. And Jesse said, "You should come and work with us at Breadbasket office after you get done with school." And I began to do that. And that's how our relationship began. I became a confidant. I called myself Mikey of the movement because I did this, that, and the other. And it grew. A relationship grew. I began to rise into leadership. I was the cultural chair for the Black Expo. I worked on the boycotts. At that time, we were boycotting grocery stores, Red Rooster, National Tea, A&P, and Jewel's. My mother didn't want me to march, and so I kind of ran the picket lines with precision. Picket lines at that time were run with precision, like an army. 100 people were supposed to be on the picket line at all times, And that became my job, is to administrate those 100 people at all times. So you would call in and say, I can march for 2 hours. And somebody else would say 4 hours. And I had to manipulate those hours and assign, make sure we had picket signs and 100 people all the time. But those are the kind of things I did in my beginning, my work with Reverend Jackson. I began to write speeches, strategies, and we just became very, very dear friends. And I became a confidant throughout the years.
Minnie Pearson, with the NAACP in Champaign County, I want to bring you into the conversation now. Talk to me from your downstate perspective, what Reverend Jackson meant for the fight for justice, you know, across Illinois, even though he was based in Chicago.
Absolutely. It was fascinating. My first time meeting Reverend Jesse Jackson at that time. He was a young man, and we had played hooky from school to go and see him in a little small black town in Mississippi called Mount Bayou. And it's right outside of Memphis. And he was with a group of people, and me, I'm looking at him at that time and saying to myself, I know we took risks to come to that place because civil rights was everywhere. Marching was everywhere. Anger was everywhere. Right around the corners, there was, you can't do this and you can't do that. Colored fountains, white bathrooms, so on and so on. And I had the nerve enough to ask him, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? And so I became known to him for that little short time as the girl who always said, why? Because I wanted to know where his energy was coming from. But early on, I could tell that he was a Christian man and he cared for human rights and he didn't discriminate among all of the adversities that was happening around us. He wanted to make sure that he looked after everyone of every race and every color. And I'm saying, but they are doing this and they're doing that to us. He's saying, what are we going to do about it? And so we got to know each other briefly. My next thing is when I left Mississippi, because I felt like I could do a lot more for myself, leaving Mississippi and coming to the North, where I would be free to do what I wanted to do. I can do this and I can say this and so on and so on. Unrealistic, you see what I didn't know what you didn't know. And my dad didn't take the time at that particular time to talk to me. Unknown to me, he was a member of an organization. He didn't tell us because it was dangerous for us as a family, as children, to know what he was doing. He would often refer to the nights that he would go out with other guys. He would go, he's going to his necessary meeting. I'm going to my necessary meeting. So I thought, okay, because I can see the church from here and I know he's not at church. So he must, and necessary that later on after I phoned him when I got to Champaign and ran into some issues that I was having and didn't know how to address those issues. He said my necessary meeting was the NAACP. And I said, what's that? And he went on to quickly explain to me how I got to that point was when I came to Champaign and I'm in the North, so I'm just feeling really good. I got a job and saving for school. And I went into this like a little cafe, and I ordered, I said to the men, I said, I want a hamburger, well done, and put the pickle on the side. And I said, would you please also toast my buns? And people in the bar laughed. But I figured they know he's so smart because I'm telling him what I need and he's not writing it down. And I said, he must be so smart. And I said, oh, and by the way, please give me a knee-high grape drink. And he says, is that all? And I said, yes. And he stumped his foot and he says, if you don't get your N-word out of here. Well, my dad had told me about the N-word and how this is, it's a common down in the South. And I figured, but now I'm in the North, I should not hear that word. So I was like a fish underwater. I couldn't hear, my legs wouldn't move. And I kept seeing the civil rights people marching, and I took off running down the street, down Market Street, to First Street under the viaduct and found a phone booth and called my dad. And he says, "What's your name?" And I told him. He says, "So if anyone calls you anything other than that, you don't answer." But at that time, I had no choice. So I left there feeling better when he told me who to get in touch with to help me to navigate through the things that I didn't understand. And one of the organizations was the NAACP and the Urban League. And also he says, and watch Jesse Jackson, Martin Luther King, John Lewis. He was naming off people for me to kind of listen to get that word, because I left Mississippi before we could have that talk. And so I watched Jesse Jackson closely. In fact, at our last Freedom Fund banquet that we had here in Champaign, one of his PUSH members came to be the keynote speaker. But the NAACP kept my eyes on people like Jesse Jackson and others, and how he knew the answer to us getting to where we need to be, constantly working for it, is to include everyone. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much it. And I've followed him ever since.
Mm. All right. We are coming up at the point where we need to take a break on the program. We're on a fixed clock here. Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show, and we are talking today about the life and legacy of the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who, as you well know, died last week at the age of 84. He spent most of his life and working career based out of Chicago, and also had a role in civil rights struggles across Illinois throughout his life, as well as his national and international profile. Joining us to talk about that today are Minnie Pearson, who we've just been hearing from, president of the NAACP in Champaign County; Hermine Hartman, who is the founder and publisher of Indigo, a Chicago-based media organization; Courtney Carson, minister at the Antioch Missionary Baptist Church, former member of the Decatur Public Schools Board; and Marcia Barrett, whom we'll hear from after this break, professor of history at the University of Illinois. If you want to join us today, the number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. We're going to continue after a short break. I'm Brian Mackey. This is the 21st Show. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about the life and times of Jesse Jackson, the civil rights activist, minister, and political leader who made his mark in Chicago and beyond. I want to share a few texts from our listener group. You can join that by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. We heard from Lloyd in Danville, who said, "What stands out is the influence that he had on society, bringing them to the polls and holding politicians and corporations accountable, that created an environment of equity. The effects on civil rights is that he advanced the agenda in a way that no one else could. His knowledge, tenacity, and grit brought adversaries to the table, actually making a better way for every underserved group. King's legacy was how Jackson influenced, developed, and promoted the idea of democracy." We also heard from Kevin in Farina, Illinois, who said, "I don't remember liking him much when I was younger, but my heart changed over the years, and I found myself quite impressed when I met him a few years ago." We're talking about Jackson with Courtney Carson, minister and community leader in Decatur, who met Jackson in the late 90s, Hermine Hartman, founder and publisher of Indigo, Minnie Pearson, president of the NAACP in Champaign County, and Marcia Barrett, professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And Professor Barrett, let me ask you about Jackson's early life. Like Minnie Pearson, he left the segregated South, came north in search of opportunity. That was in the form of the University of Illinois, which didn't work out so well for him, and later Chicago. But can you just tell us a little bit about Jackson's early life in Greenville, South Carolina?
Sure. So he had a difficult, a time, say in many different ways, in part because of his parentage and sort of how the how some in the community perceived, sort of his, background coming from, this sort of non-traditional family, but he or family structure, but he was very successful in terms of his education. He was a really talented athlete, and he considered, playing football in college, I think baseball as well, maybe other sports, but he was aware, right, in South Carolina, that he would not be able to attend a predominantly white institution and play sports there. And I think that was part of the reason why he was interested in attending the University of Illinois. He was able to, he came on a football scholarship, but actually similar to sort of what the account you just heard from Mrs. Pearson, he recounted that when he was at the University of Illinois, that was actually the first time in his life they'd ever been called the N-word. He thought that he was going, these are his words, going to the land of Lincoln, the promised land of the North. And ultimately he came away thinking that it was essentially the same thing as South Carolina, just way off somewhere else, was what he told his biographer, Marshall Frady. So he ended up only staying at the University of Illinois for a year, in part because, of the racism he experienced. He was sort of treated as an outsider, and was unable to find, sort of support and sort of like a system to sort of help him navigate this new space when he was on the campus. So he left after a year. But I also think it's very interesting. He then later returned to Illinois when he attended seminary in Chicago. But when we hear about Martin Luther King Jr.'s experience in Chicago and Cicero saying that he had never experienced racism as virulent as he did when he tried to move his campaign to the north, to Chicago, I think about Jesse Jackson and that he would have understood what King was going to experience in a way that maybe many others in his circle did not, because he had experienced something very similar just, 6 years earlier when he first moved to Illinois.
Courtney Carson, I want to return to you now. You were in Decatur, and of course, as I mentioned before the break, you were one of the young men caught up in that episode at the football stands. I don't know how much you want to speak to that and the specifics of that and Jackson's role in it, or take it where you will, or his mentorship of you over the years as that relationship evolved.
Amy, yeah, thank you so much. Well, during that particular point in time, that was the scariest moment in my life. During that fight, quite naturally, the school district expelled us for 2 years. The police department charged us with two felony mob action charges, right? So quite, that looks like the school to prison pipeline. And so my mother called out, reached out to Reverend Jackson, some of the local ministers here, they reached out to Reverend Jackson, and Reverend Jackson came down to save us, essentially. The Ku Klux Klan came down at the simultaneously. It seemed like when Reverend got here, then they showed up. When we marched, they marched. We had another march, and then they marched again. I remember hearing one of the Klansmen sang on the radio station here in Decatur. When they saw Courtney Carson, they would string him up. At the particular point in time, it was they could say my name because I was, of age, I guess. But that was a frightening moment in my life. And Reverend Jackson, when he came in, it's almost like, when you're praying to God, for whatever the reason, to be healed, to be delivered from a thing, Reverend Jackson came and delivered us. And the Rainbow Push came down in busloads just so that that individuals could know that they meant to really get these kids, including myself, back into school and at least an alternative education. At the particular point in time, the school district did not offer even an alternative education. We could not go to the public library for whatever reason. And we, because the Klan was in town and Matt Hale was in town, we were afraid to go. We were afraid to leave our house. So we was kind of stuck in the confines in our own home. And it was a scary moment. But whenever Reverend Jackson came back into town, I personally felt good about him being here. We felt safe. I think Reverend Jackson's divinity rests on his ability to care for those who are locked out and locked up and made to feel as if they are the least, the left out, and essentially the lost. And his ability to, you know, he was multifaceted. He liked to help heal the wounds of the world by being actively involved in bettering the lives of others. And so while his approach was to, whether he was in Syria, whether he was in Cuba, whether he was in 99, he was in Kosovo, and at the same time in Decatur, Illinois, ensuring that I get a proper education. So he was all over the world, but he made sure that he was focused on his own home where he lived in the state of Illinois. And I thank God for that. I know of no other individual that could have that could spread their wings the way that Reverend Jackson did. Because when presidents could not negotiate the release of hostages or POWs, Reverend Jackson could. And so we in America owe him more than just flowers. We owe him everything because he changed the course of how we vote, how we look at life, how we see America, how we look at ourselves and our enemies, right? I mean, today we're free, but not as equal. And that's a dangerous statement when this country is wiping black names off of buildings and history out of books. We are in a dangerous space. And I wonder where Reverend Jackson would be on this day. I just believe he would be on the cutting edge of echoing, "Let my people live, let my people go," because they are somebody. And he would definitely be reminding us to keep hope alive. And so when Reverend Jackson was able to take me under his wing after I became, you know, after I was the case, he allowed me to be a part of his inner circle. After I got my GED, then I got my bachelor's degree, then I got my master's degree, and then I ran for school board and won, and he was right there coaching me along the way. Then he was giving me so many insights, and it's magnificent because I don't understand and I don't see the Reverend Jackson that, you know, we typically hear about as it relates to he was a guy that only showed up when the cameras were around. Well, when Reverend Jackson talked to me at 2 a.m., there was no cameras. When I called Reverend Jackson because I was challenged by controversy, he always answered, "There was no cameras." When I would cry in my dorm room because I didn't have the funds to keep up, you know, the funds to go to college, I almost was about to quit school because I just did not have the funds. He didn't go on the radio or the television and say, "I'm going to provide this young man with a scholarship so that he can continue his education." There were no cameras around, but what was around was his love, his passion, his empathy, his heart to make sure that I landed in a space and I became the very person that God wanted me to be. And that was Reverend Jackson's heart.
I'm so glad you mentioned that idea that so many people have. And look, I was born after the civil rights era. I became my political awareness came after he had made his runs for president. And for mm-hmm. many people in America today, he was a figure on TV, showing up here, showing up there. And Hermine Hartman, let me ask you about that, because, you know, as we heard, he was in Kosovo or in Serbia in 1999, and he was in Decatur, and he had been in Normal at the Mitsubishi plant in central Illinois as women were fighting harassment in the workplace there. How did he choose his fights? How did he choose where to get involved?
Well, one of the things you should know about Reverend Jackson is he read newspapers, all of the newspapers and the news magazines, yes, constantly. Mm-hmm. And when he saw trouble, problems, issues, he figured out, could he address them? And if he thought he could bring some light, some energy, some focus on them, he did. It wasn't that he showed up when the camera showed up. It was that the camera showed up when he showed up.
Right.
That's really how that worked. He was a strategist. He was decisive. I remember the Decatur situation quite well because I was with him and kind of did some of the press work for him at that time. When Reverend saw injustice, he went to it. He went to it when he saw it, wherever he saw it. And if he thought he could do something about it, he addressed it. He addressed it maybe with marching. He was a terrific negotiator. He negotiated as best he could. If the negotiation did not work, was not effective, then he took it to the next level, which was to bring people and to march and to bring the press. The press for Reverend Jackson wasn't Reverend Jackson on TV. The press for Reverend Jackson was the press was a tool to communicate.
Yes.
What was happening, maybe what was bad, what was negative. That was his style. He, on a television program I did called Indigo Studio, I asked Reverend Jackson to describe his leadership style, and he said, it's quite situational. And I think that is probably the best way to explain him, is it's situational. He listened, he would listen to all sides, and then he would make a decision as to this is right, this is wrong, and he would try to negotiate it into some kind of settlement. That was his way. That's the way he did things. And it definitely wasn't he showed up when the camera showed up. Right. The camera showed up when he showed up. That needs correcting. He was perpetual. If he got on a project, he worked it until it got completed, until it got done, until it got finished, until it got resolved. He was excessively energetic. Most people, young, old, white, black, wherever, could not keep up with him.
Right.
Because he just didn't stop. Mr. Carson has told you about some phone calls at 2 o'clock in the morning. I can tell you about phone calls just about every day at 5 o'clock in the morning. So sometimes I would say to him, Reverend, you need to go to sleep, you need to rest, and you need to leave people alone. But that was him. I called him sometimes the energized bunny, because if he was on something, he was on it and he would not stop until it became satisfactory to all parties involved. One of the things about Reverend's negotiating style, I think to be noted, is he negotiated win-wins. Mm-hmm. He didn't negotiate win-loses. He negotiated win-win-wins, that everybody would win as he proposed solutions. He was decisive. He was a solution guy. Bring me a solution. He would ask you for a solution. What's the best thing we can do here? In the situation that you're talking about in Decatur, he was incensed that those young men were penalized for 2 years. 2 years, you're taking a young life and you're just exhausting it and putting it into a negative mode unnecessarily. Right. And he fought that. He fought wrongdoings and social ills in our society, around the world, as he could.
Yes.
Minnie Pearson, we need to take a break in another minute and a half, but I know you were trying to get in there a few moments ago.
Yes. I attended the University of Illinois as well for my undergrad and my graduate degree, along with training student teachers. And I can understand the climate at that time. And he really, the short while he was here, he did leave a footprint. He really did. And all of his actions, he worked through the system here, all of his actions was rooted in faith. He wanted us to know that we could draw from a higher power, a strength, to make sure that everybody benefited from what they were owed. And I could see that, but at that time it was limited. I mean, you run into a brick wall, but he would keep it going. Later on, we had the 500 students that came to the University of Illinois to kind of integrate everything. He believed that moral leadership extended beyond the borders of the college campus, and that advocating for justice internationally, straight from America's commitment to human rights, he really lived that each and every day. And we're so glad. First time I heard the word systemic racism, his commitment was rooted, like I said, in faith and the community empowerment, that he believed that organizations collectively and their actions could transform America. He almost like he had a vision. He had a vision, and he was going to work for that. Thank you.
All right, we will continue this conversation after another short break. We are talking about the life and legacy of the Reverend Jesse Jackson. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. I'm Brian Mackey. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking today about the life and legacy of the Reverend Jesse Jackson. A few more messages from listeners. Terry in Batavia said he was a leader, rubbed many in the white establishment the wrong way, and made some waves in the African-American establishment as well. He was a great man who inspired others and who affected change. What a proud legacy he leaves behind him. We also heard from Amy in Wakanda, who said he made enemies. And that means he was disturbing the powers that be. And that means he was doing something right. Rest in power, Mr. Jackson. May the next generations carry your torch forward now. Jackson also had a way of connecting with people through the media, through popular culture. We have a couple of clips of some of those notable appearances. First, let's listen to him on the kids program, Sesame Street, 1972.
I am. Somebody.
Somebody.
I am. Somebody.
Somebody.
I may be poor.
I may be poor.
But I am.
I am.
Somebody.
Somebody.
I may be young.
I may be young.
But I am.
But I am.
Somebody.
Somebody.
I may be on welfare.
I may be on welfare.
But I am.
But I am.
Somebody.
Somebody.
I may be small.
I may be small.
But I am.
But I am.
Somebody.
Somebody.
I may make a mistake.
Jackson also had the ability to make jokes at his own expense. He appeared a couple of times on Saturday Night Live, once as the host. And in this clip, he made fun of the media and their ability to find fault with his every move. This is October 20th, 1984, after his run for the presidency.
And I found in this contest that you just really can't satisfy the press. Press said, Jesse Jackson's not going to run. Well, I ran. They said, well, Jesse Jackson won't finish. Well, I did. They said I wouldn't get Lieutenant Robert Goodman from Syria. Well, I did. And with Reagan's help, I was able to get him back home. Then the press didn't want to find out how I got Goodman back. They want to know who paid the hotel bill in Syria. Luckily, Jesse Jackson, the Pope, was riding this boat. While they were riding the boat, a stiff wind came along and blew the Pope's holy cap off. Pope reached for it and couldn't get it. Jesse Jackson couldn't get it. They said, well, what happened? They said, well, Jesse got up and walked across the water. Got the Pope's cap. And brought it back, and the Pope was grateful. He's a very gracious man. He put his cap back on, and the press was riding in the next boat over. And they start typing this miraculous event. Next one, the headlines wrote, Jesse can't swim.
All right, we are talking today about his life with Courtney Carson, minister and community leader in Decatur, who got to know Jackson in the late 90s and onward. Hermine Hartman, founder and publisher of Indigo. Marcia Barrett, professor of history at the University of Illinois. And Minnie Pearson, president of the NAACP in Champaign County. Professor Barrett, let's talk about those presidential runs. This was recently the subject of a book by Abby Phillip. She said it was a sort of overlooked aspect of his career and legacy. That was her sort of assertion and her reason for doing this book. Can you talk about what he was trying to do there and what the legacy of that has been in American politics?
Definitely. But I actually would take this story back before 1984 and connect Jesse Jackson to the civil rights activists who had been working to truly integrate the Democratic Party, you know, in the early 1960s, right? Trying to make the Democratic Party responsive to young people, racial minorities, women. He was following in the footsteps of people like Fannie Lou Hamer, who in the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party that challenged the Democratic Party's system of, who were the delegates allowed to represent particular states in 1964. So I jump ahead to 1972, where Jesse Jackson actually led an alternate Illinois delegation to the Democratic National Convention in Miami that year. And unlike previous attempts, he was actually able to lead and, I should say, unseat the delegation that was led by Mayor Richard Daley. So you see Jesse Jackson being a part of this longer tradition of activists who are trying to make the Democratic Party more responsive to the needs of this sort of increasingly diverse constituency. And then he sort of really fully this sort of becomes fully formed in the 1980s when he sought office as the Democratic Party's presidential nominee. And I think people often maybe forget that, or especially the students I talked to, they're not aware that he was third in that race in 1984. He was second place right behind the eventual nominee in 1988. And it was a really sort of contentious time for the Democratic Party, where it was considered a bad, the word liberal was now a bad word. And Jesse Jackson was embracing the label of liberal, the ideals of, the great society, and sort of saying the Democratic Party needed to meet the needs of the working poor, people who were often on the outside. So he continued that challenge that activists before him led, and then had this really impressive success where the Democratic Party and its establishment, you had to respond, it had to change and become more responsive to the communities that he was bringing to the table. And I think many times the establishment wanted to be dismissive of his challenge, but he was incredibly successful. And I think people now recognize that he changed the party in ways and sort of that, we sort of see more fully formed today. And even if the Democratic Party is still in this sort of a new crisis, you can certainly look back to Jackson's challenge then to get a sense of what's at the core of this conflict.
And indeed, Bernie Sanders seems to have become an ally of Jackson's over the years.
Yes, definitely. He supported him in his, I think, at least the 1988 run. But yes, there was definitely a lot of sort of shared ideals in between those two.
Yeah,
years.
And vice versa. I understand there was some event in 2024 when the Democratic National Convention was in Chicago, and Sanders and many other people spoke highly of sort of looking back at Jackson's life and legacy at that time as well. Hermine Hartman, talk to me about activism and where it's gone, where American activism, especially among Black Americans, has gone, and how Jackson, might have perceived that direction today.
Jesse was a galvanizer. When Jesse ran for president, he galvanized Black America and brought real change. One of the things I want us to remember, Jesse didn't want to run for president. Jesse ran for president because nobody else would run. There was a Jesse's publicist, communications director, who was named Frank Watkins. And Frank had done a white paper, kind of a position paper, on what the Black vote could mean if unified at this time. It was quite the paper. It was the groundwork for we could run for president and win. Jesse went to Maynard Jackson, who was the former mayor of Atlanta, and asked him if he would run after presenting this position paper. And he said no. He was done with politics. It was time for him to go into enterprise. Then he went to Andrew Young, and Andy also said no. And refused. And then Jesse finally concluded, well, I think I'm going to have to run for president. So that is where that came from. The civil rights movement, activism, organizing, development, went into action as Jackson ran for president. And let's keep something very critical in mind. There was no money. There were no PACs. There were no foundation money. There was no grants. Monies came from the people. It came from church offerings. It came from community offerings. It came from, let's just pass the hat where we are and let's see how we do. The drive that he had, the commitment that he had, the energy that he had was absolutely amazing as to we the people. That was kind of one of the slogans, we the people can do this. And so it was wonderful. It was also, I think, pays us to note that on the debate stage, they would only take the top three candidates at one point. That was kind of policy, the top three poll candidates. Jesse challenged that. He contested that to say, no, no, American public needs to see all of us. And he got on that stage. That rule changed too. And he got on that stage. And in doing so, America saw Jesse, not Black America, but America at large saw Jesse in a new light. One of the things that he did in those debates, as they talked about NATO, and he was, of course, the only Black man on that stage, Biden included on that stage, Dukakis included on that stage. But as they talked about NATO, Jesse began to raise the question about apartheid in South Africa and a man named Nelson Mandela, who was in jail and had been in jail for 28 years. Jesse began to raise the question of apartheid. He began to raise the question of corporate supporting apartheid. He began to raise the question of when does Mandela get released from jail? That was the beginning of a movement that came about for Mandela's release. That was from that Jesse Jackson debate stage. So Jesse was a change agent. Everywhere he went, everything he did, he brought the change. And I think on the debate stage, when he ran for president, he opened up America to America. As he points out in one of the speeches that you just played, there are more white women on welfare than Black women. He showed America what they looked like in a mirror. It wasn't Black. Jesse fought racism. He lifted the Black veil and made America look at itself in its fullness. I think that's what he really did, and that's what his activism was. And we'll be talking about Jesse for years. There will be many books written on Jesse, but we will talk about that impact that he has had on this country, on this world. As private citizen, I think that's something else to note, is that Jesse was private citizen, never elected official. That's very significant to note. When Jesse went to get Goodman, when he went for the rescue missions, the government did not support him. He wasn't on government planes. He did not have CIA with him. He did not have security with him. He did that on his own initiative with his own funds, and he won every time on moral judgment.
I think that's a great point on which to end our conversation. Hermine Hartman was a longtime ally and confidant of Jesse Jackson, founder and publisher of Indigo. Courtney Carson, minister and community leader in Decatur. Minnie Pearson, president of the NAACP in Champaign County. And Marcia Barrett, professor of history at the University of Illinois. Thank you all so much for being with us and sharing your perspectives with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was an honor.
And I want to give the last word to the Reverend Jackson himself. This is from the Democratic National Convention, July 19th, 1988, in Atlanta, Georgia.
Every one of these funny labels they put on you, those of you who are watching this broadcast tonight in the projects, on the corners, I understand. Call you outcast, low down, you can't make it, you're nothing, you're from nobody. Subclass, underclass, when you see Jesse Jackson, when my name goes in nomination, your name goes in nomination. I was born in the slum, but the slum was not born in me. And it wasn't born in you, and you can make it. Wherever you are tonight, you can make it. Hold your head high. Stick your chest out. You can make it. It gets dark sometimes, but the morning comes. Don't you surrender. Suffering breeds character. Character breeds faith. In the end, faith will not disappoint. You must not surrender. You may or may not get there, but just know that you are qualified and you hold on and hold out. We must never surrender. America will get better and better. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive. On tomorrow night and beyond. Keep hope alive. I love you very much.
That is it for us today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.